LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Susan Martinez, who joins us to discuss her latest book, Delusions in Science and Spirituality, The Fall of the Standard Model and the Rise of Knowledge from Unseen Worlds. What if science and society's most cherished theories, taught as fact, were actually wrong? What if the anomalies that disprove these theories were covered up and distorted, and any serious challenges brushed off as lunacy, hysteria, pseudoscience, or conspiracy? In this primer in deprogramming, Martinez reveals the disinformation at the root of mainstream consensus thinking. She punches gaping holes in the established theories of the Big Bang, Darwinian evolution, ice ages, and global warming. Drawing on the ancient science of the unseen and some of the most advanced thinkers in astrophysics, she explains a new theory of everything to replace the standard model. Martinez reveals how the instability of society itself has found its way into our theories, positing explosive change and acceleration where there is none. She explains how human evolution did not suddenly accelerate 40,000 years ago, and culture did not accelerate to birth civilization a mere 6,000 years ago. She shows how the theories of the Freudian and Jungian unconscious and of reincarnation have grossly misrepresented the spirit of man and the psyche of humanity, resurrecting the majestic order that was once recognized at the basis of reality. Martinez shows that the shift from the age of disinformation to the age of understanding is well underway. Hello and welcome, Susan, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Okay, that's first I heard your name, and I'm going to make a note of it.
Excellent. Well, today, Susan, we're going to be talking about your latest book, which is entitled Delusions in Science and Spirituality. Subtitle is The Fall of the Standard Model and the Rise of Knowledge from Unseen Worlds. Before we dive into that, tell listeners just a little bit about your background and your work.
I think the best thing to say is that when I was young, I went to graduate school. I got a degree in anthropology. The branch of anthropology I specialized in was linguistic anthropology. And then I spent 2 years in teaching, and I didn't like it. I dropped out. That was a lot of decades ago, and I've been on my own ever since. So I've been freelancing, but in recent years I got back to some material that I had dealt with in my graduate school days, stuff like evolution. And I guess the last three books I've written have been about ancient mysteries, but this present one, Delusions, kind of sums up my thinking in a lot of fields of knowledge, so that it's actually the first book I've written where each chapter is on a totally different subject.
Yeah, to say the book is wide-ranging would be an understatement. Yesterday, actually, when I was completing the book, I was sat in a coffee shop, and a lady at the next table actually somehow managed to read the title of the book, and she said, "Oh, that looks interesting." And So I was going to try to explain to her what it was, and as I said, it's rather wide-ranging. So I said to her, "Well, it's kind of if I was to sum it up, it's kind of everything you think you know is wrong." Really, and that's how I'd characterize your book.
The book was getting something, excuse me, off my chest, because in every area and every discipline that I have dealt with, because I have also written on about spiritualism and the psyche. Every area I went to, whether it was science or self or society, is full of paradigms that are false. Either they're outdated and should have been cast aside a century ago, or there's something basically wrong in the standard model. I end up saying that I think the root of the wrongness is in philosophy of materialism. See, so all of our sciences, all of our fields of knowledge are based on a materialist viewpoint. And what I'm bringing out is all the important stuff that's in the unseen world, the intangible world.
Yeah, this is something, this is an issue that I deal with a lot in interviews, actually. And in many ways, this talk could be a companion piece to the one that I did last week, and discussing, you know, the materialism and how it dominates everything. But it's a relatively recent thing.
It's recent in the broader sense. When thinking became really scientized in the 19th century, they cast out the Bible, they cast out the heavens, they cast out God himself. God was considered unscientific, and that holds till this day. So it's been the entire 20th century and now carrying over into this one. I think the paradigm is changing. I think in the next generation or two, we're going to see that change really manifest. Materialism has been king for over a century.
Yeah, I think really you're pointing out in the book that science and spirituality to some extent have gone off track. As a species, we sort of crave certainty. You know, we kind of want to know what the answers are so that we can sleep at night. But ironically, you point out that science, for all that it informs modern life so much, is simultaneously very certain of itself and yet very vague when it wants to be. So it's kind of like has cast iron answers. This is how things are. And yet the more you probe into the answers, the more vague it actually gets. And the more scientists are saying, well, actually, we've got no idea what's going on. So it's a strange...
Oh, that's so true.
Yeah, it's a strange dichotomy, isn't it, really?
It is. They play both ends of the game. The we don't know game and we may never know game, which I don't agree with. I think we will be fully enlightened. I think that's part of our destiny. And then on the other hand, like you say, cast iron fact made out of speculation.
Well, when I talk about, I've had conversations with people sometimes about scientific theories, and I'll say, for example, like one of the big headline issues that you tackle in the book is evolution. And evolution clearly happens, but I think there are some issues with the way it's been presented to us. But I'll say to someone, well, it is just a theory. And then what I usually find countering that is that this person in defense of science will say, well, everything's a theory. I'm not sure that really moves us too far forward.
Right, and that's the relativism that I think I launch into also, that everything is relative and that there are no absolutes. I think that's part of the godlessness of today's science, not recognizing that there are absolutes.
Yeah, and I think that becomes dangerous as well when you apply it to human, you know, behavior and morals and what have you. You know, there's no such thing as right and wrong.
Exactly.
I guess what you're saying, really, I mean, the word unseen, as I mentioned, is in the subtitle of your book. And I think that's what you're emphasizing, that we're ignoring at our peril, really, and that there's non-material forces that interact with the material. You point out how, for example, in the Victorian era, that, you know, it's the ether, the idea of the ether, which was pervasive at one time, that was driven out. And yet in quantum physics, we're moving back towards trying to replace that idea of the ether with something else. And we, you know, there's persistent ideas that keep coming up of a void and abyss. And then you get into quanta and dark matter themselves, dark energy, black holes. And it's kind of moving back to reclaim some territory that was abandoned.
It's just jargon, you know. They're talking about dark matter or dark energy. That's really the same as the ether that they cast out 100 years ago, or more than 100 years ago, but it's coming back. In fact, the only website I have, I don't have an author website or a promotional website at all, but the one I have and put together with a few partners is called earthvortex.com, and it goes into quite a bit about the ether, the etheric science.
One of the big issues that you tackle is the very origin of, you know, life, the universe, and everything, which is about as big as it gets. And you talk about the notion of the Big Bang, which Fred Hoyle, the astronomer, he coined that term, even though he was actually dismissive of the idea in itself. So tell us a little bit about your perspective on that.
Well, I think it was in the late 1940s, it might have been 1948, that Hoyle was on the radio, and he was referring to the Big Bang dismissively. He coined the phrase just offhandedly to spoof it, and yet it caught on. Hoyle was quite a genius and quite a wonderful personality. In fact, he was from your area, of England. He believed in the alternative to the Big Bang, and he called it a continuous creation, in which case there was no beginning.
Yet, to an extent, you point out as well, the curious thing about the Big Bang is it really does smack of let there be light. You know, creation ex nihilo, something from nothing. And what is the difference between that and a God sitting on a cloud and saying, let there be light?
Well, something from nothing is hard to understand, but the assumption there is that there was a starting point, and then they put an exact date on it, 13.7 billion years ago. I mean, that's ridiculous. They're using, you know, a blanket, they're using factual, factoids, you know, factual cover to make it look like it's real, but it's simply a consensus, view.
Yeah, this is something that will seem counterintuitive to a lot of people, but I've recently, in a couple of interviews in the last month or so, I've been discussing the idea that something always existed, basically, and I think that our minds are repelled by it somehow, but I think that's partly just a limitation of our way of thinking because, you know, that we live such short lives and all around us we see creation, you know, and destruction, you know, birth and death. And the idea that there's always been something, I don't think we can wrap our minds around it, but that's not to say that we should dismiss it.
I know, and I think that's quite true. We're mortals. We live a finite existence here in the body, but we go on to an eternal existence out of the body as spirits. There are things in the finite condition that we just can't understand, can't wrap our minds around. But that doesn't mean it's not a possible. And I think people with faith have a sense of accepting things that are possibles, even though we can't wrap our minds around it.
I was interested in your view that you feel that there's not, maybe there isn't anything that we can ultimately not know, but just, I mean, I always considered, for example, that there are things that may ultimately just be beyond the limits of human understanding, and that it's rather arrogant of us to imagine that we can have some kind of ultimate truth, but you don't appear to necessarily share that view.
Yes. Well, one aspect of that is that I believe that the destiny of mankind is to be spiritualized. I think that is the process that's just beginning now. I actually wrote a book about that. It was a book about prophecy. It was called Time of the Quickening. I wrote that book about 5 years ago. The planet is getting old and mankind is getting old. We're a bit more than halfway through our journey here. And I have studied prophecy. I read the Oaste Bible, which has a great deal of information on what's to happen in the future. I think we're reaching the most critical turning point in our history here, in our career here on the planet. I think that these prophecies have pinpointed the year 2048 as a major turning point, so we're not very far away. And from that point on, all the institutions on Earth that have not worked out, and the major thing is wars, it's going to be a turning point there. There's going to be a very major collapse of all our institutions that do not work in a positive way for mankind. Things are going to rebuild on more on the community level. And at the same time, the spiritualism is coming to the fore. We're beginning to see and realize the importance of things that are in the unseen world.
What's the significance of 2048? I've not heard that date cited before.
Well, it's dealing with prophetic numbers. They're very specific numbers, and they originated in an Egyptian system 12,000 years ago. So we're dealing, 99, or 100 is one of those units of, prophecy. So, the opening year of the new era, the new era, the opening year was 1848. That happened to be the year that the, Rochester Rappings happened and the Hydesville and Fox Sisters came into prominence. Well, that's not a coincidence. That was when the spirit world became known and became very popular. It started in America, moved over to England. But in any case, that's the year, that was the first turning point. And in Oaste, which I follow and which I use, it's called the Cosman Era. Cosman stands for cosmic man, and that's what we're moving into now. So 1848 plus 100 is 1948. 1948 plus 100 is 2048. I was just talking with a colleague yesterday about 1948, and I'm currently reading a book about the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover and whatnot, and I became aware that the Cold War began there at that 100-year point after the dawn of Cosman. That was just around 1948, and that was a whole cycle that ended in 1990. Anyway, we're looking at all the rapid changes that are occurring, look how quickly the Soviet system and communism fell. And the same is going to happen with the Republican form, the so-called Democratic form, because it doesn't work for either. There are still wars, there's still poverty, there's still despair.
Well, I remember the Berlin Wall coming down like it was yesterday, and you mention tangentially in your book Francis Fukuyama and this end of history idea. And I have to say, I thought that was absolute, utter nonsense when he came out with that.
I know. And we listen to the words of experts as if it's the truth, but it's opinion.
How do you consider, how do you match up the sort of feeling that most civilizations seems to have had in the past, that they've somehow reached an apex and that they're special, and it turns out they're not really? How do you match that up with this idea at the minute that, you know, it really does feel that something is happening that hasn't happened before, or maybe not for a very long time?
Well, I think that's a genuine perception, because, like I say, the era of Cosman marks the turning point for mankind. if I were to give the actual years, mankind has been around for 75,000 years up till now, and we're going to be around for another 75,000 years. Those are the figures I use. So we're at the midpoint. Actually, we're past the midpoint. And what people feel and sense, this is true. They can perceive that something major is going on. I mean, people are waking up and smelling the coffee. How many more generations are we going to send our sons off to war? I can't even picture another one. Can you?
Well, there does seem to be a lot of resistance in that area, I have to say. I mean, I remember, you know, a million people marched in London at the start of the last Iraq war to protest it. Now, it went ahead anyway. Those people were ignored, of course. But nevertheless, it was very significant. And I think that's why you see, in terms of military technology now, I know you mentioned military budgets towards the end of your book, but that's why I'm convinced that's why you're seeing the rise of drones and why airstrikes are being used and all this talk of boots on the ground is being dismissed because there is enormous resistance. You know, particularly Americans don't like to see coffins coming back, you know, with the stars and stripes draped over them.
They have blacked it out from the news very strictly.
Yeah, absolutely. They won't show. I mean, I've seen in this country online, I've seen pictures of, you know, a military transport plane unloading coffins. I mean, dozens and dozens of coffins with, you know, soldiers' bodies in them. And as I understand it, you cannot show that on American TV.
Right.
Because it brings it home, doesn't it, really? It really just reminds people of what, I mean, the families affected are all too aware of what the cost is. But something like that is just a psychologically really does something, I think, to people.
Yes, and that's what people are going to catch on pretty soon, that some things have been suppressed because if they were exposed to it, the sentiments would go in the other direction, away from all the propaganda toward war, militarism, and everything else. And the gap between the haves and have-nots is growing. All of this is, you know, like a bubble ready to burst.
Yeah, I think it was Einstein who said, I'm paraphrasing here, but something along the lines of the pioneers of a warless world are the young men and women who refuse military service. And it really is that simple. But of course, that's what all the propaganda is about, is to convince people, particularly those that they want to recruit into the military, that they're doing something vital here, you know, the so-called defending our freedom, you know, which is just a bad joke.
Right. So I'm basically saying, you know, we've been brainwashed and we've got to wake up and smell the coffee and start thinking for ourselves. This is not only in the political area, but also in all the academic topics that I touch on. There's a whole new way of thinking about each of these subjects, but there's a clock ticking and, you know, there's not much time left for that game.
Yeah, you mentioned the age of the Earth a while ago, and that's an interesting point that you make in the book, is that in terms of the age of the Earth and other planetary bodies, stars, that bright, hot, fast in terms of movement denotes a young age, as it were, and then got this gradual process, very long process of entropy and cooling, and so that dim and cold and slow is, you know, as the planetary bodies move towards the end of their life. And we see that with, you know, stars that have gone supernova and shrunk in size. And you point out that in our own solar system, for example, Mars is a good example of basically a dead planet, or as good as. And that's interesting in itself in the context of the search for life on Mars and the Mars One project that you might have heard about, the idea of colonizing it.
Oh, yeah, they call it terraforming. And I think that's ridiculous. And I really don't know what's motivating them in this, unless it's just research money that's coming in. There's some kind of concept that if things go south here on Earth, you know, we'll be able to migrate over to Mars or some other planet. I mean, it's just laughable. And I cannot believe that serious scientists are talking about colonizing a place like Mars, which is obviously a dead or dying planet. It shows every symptom of planetary death, drying, cooling, and loss of atmosphere. Everything about it tells us that this is a perfect example of a dead planet, and we can learn about planetary extinction by studying it, but certainly not fooling the people and saying it's a place we could go and set up shop.
No, I've always considered it rather fanciful. And, you know, environmentalists, for example, are fond of saying that, well, you know, the idea that we should be allow ourselves to go to another planet considering what we're doing to this one. But I looked at the Mars One project. There's no very little actual science behind it. And in terms of their projected dates of when they're wanting to do things, not only do they not have the money in place, but all the projects that need to be underway, not least of which is building a craft suitable to go there, they're not even begun. There's no projected start dates. In terms of companies being contracted in to do the work, I think there's one company involved, but they're not actually doing anything. They've just signed a piece of paper. So the whole thing is just absolute cloud cuckoo land.
I think it's diabolic. I think a lot of what's going on is diabolic. To me, saying that we could abandon the Earth and go somewhere else it's the same psychology that says, oh, if I don't do okay in this lifetime, I'll just be reborn in another lifetime and do better. They're both entirely cynical philosophies, and they're totally evading the fact that right now is what counts, right now what we do. And this Earth is our home, and no other place is going to be our home physically.
You also talk in the book, and this is very interesting because this is something that's come up in a number of interviews that I've done, the idea of certain types of patterns and certain types of movement in the universe. I'm thinking particularly here of the vortex, because we see spirals everywhere in nature. If you look at an animation you can find online of the solar system's path through the galaxy, that's a corkscrew type movement. We see circles everywhere. Circles are tremendously significant in, you know, the symbolism of our species, and there's a reason for that. So just to see those from the smallest motion, you know, at a subatomic level right through to the cosmic, to see these same patterns surely must be telling us something.
Many, many years ago, I read a book by the Japanese sage Michio Kushi, and it was called The Spiral of Life. I don't have it, and I haven't read it for many years, but that phrase always stuck in my mind. And when I did research and writing about archaeology, you have, as you mentioned, you always see spirals on etched into rocks. It's from the ancient world that they used that same symbol as the spiral of life. And the vortex science brings it all together. That's where I think we really have our theory of everything, right there in that spiral, because the vortex itself is a spiralic corkscrew motion. And if I give it a quick definition, it is for the Earth's vortex is approximately what we call the magnetic field. The top of the vortex is where the moon is at, and the power station of the Earth's vortex is the ionosphere, which is very close to the Earth. It starts about 60 miles above the Earth, and that's where all the magnetism, electricity, heat, and light comes from. That shoots down to the Earth in the daytime. That energy is called vortexia. Then when it shoots out the Earth in the nighttime, that energy is called m-vortexia. It comes out the North Pole, and the sign of it is the aurora borealis. We can see it. There's even free energy there in that. So there's a great deal to learn in vortexian science, and that's what I'm concentrating on.
Have you ever seen the Northern Lights?
I've just looked at a lot of pictures. Have you seen it, Greg?
Do you know what? I did last month, and I never expected to do so in, you know, necessarily in my life without making a special trip. But I went to Iceland, and our hosts there told us that it was really too late in the season to be seeing the lights. But we were outside one night, and they just appeared. And even the Icelanders were like amazed that they had, and it was just incredible. You know, it's like everybody was, you know, this was a group of guys who were like drinking beer and talking too much, and everybody just went silent.
I'm guessing it was green.
Yes, green.
How did I know, Greg? I mean, it just came to me. What were they, swirls or what?
Just streaks, long streaks in the sky. One of our party was a photographer, and he had very good camera with him, and he photographed them and then went indoors and brought the pictures up on his computer. And it was interesting that what the photographs were different to what we saw. And we had this conversation about, well, a camera isn't a human eye. So what we saw, you know, the camera was able to pick up more than we could see, which is just interesting in itself.
That is amazing. Yes.
Because the camera showed that the lights were green and purple, but we didn't see any purple. And I think the photographer said that the camera could see something like, well, I can't remember how many colors, but maybe 10,000 or who knows how many thousand colors, that, and the human eye could see much less than that.
Okay. And right there, we have a great example of what I'm doing in the book, because at many points in the book, I have to say that what the experts are saying is 180 degrees different from what I think is the truth. In Vortexian science, the auroras are simply the emission of Vortexian energy out of the poles. So it's coming out of the poles. What does science say? Science says it's coming, that the solar wind is driving it from the sun down to the earth. In other words, 180 degrees opposite.
Another topic that you take down in the book is the very idea of evolution. Again, as I mentioned earlier, it's not that evolution doesn't occur, but it's just that the nature of it, for example, particularly you have an issue with the idea of natural selection and competition. And this is something, obviously, that Darwin put forward. And ultimately, that's not harmless, because that really has affected, I think, how we as a species see each other and the rest of the environment. And it's actually been a very, very, very destructive notion, the idea of competition.
Right, survival of the fittest, competition. It all verges on a master race theory. And I go into that a bit. And previous to the Delusions book, I wrote a book refuting Darwinian evolution, and it was called The Mysterious Origins of Hybrid Man. One of my great inspirations in writing that was a countryman of yours, that's Richard Milton, who back in the late 1990s, I think it was, wrote a similar book called Shattering the Myth of Darwinism, something like that. And the powers that be really came down on him, but it was, I won't exactly say who it was who made the comment that he was a fruitcake who needed psychiatric help, but it was one of your, big spokesmen there in England who tried to tear him to shreds. It turns out that is such a great falsehood. Milton wrote a brilliant book and has always been a brilliant researcher and journalist. So my book on hybrid man is just the latest in a series of anti-Darwin books, but there's one new element I brought to bear, and this is actually, I summarized my findings in chapter 2 of the Delusion book. I don't think evolution ever happened. I don't think any bit of it is true, because They are trying to say that when you have all these different types of fossil men, that one type evolved out of the other. And I am saying, no, that's not what happened. They came about because of interbreeding between different racial types. There was a whole lot of crossbreeding in the early day in the Paleolithic, and that's what accounts for the different types of hominids that we have found in the fossil record. Not evolution at all.
So what has your research indicated to you then about the origins of life on Earth, whether that's, you know, microbial life billions of years ago or, you know, hominids or and everything in between?
I'm no expert in that, Greg, because that's quite an abstraction. I think it's beyond my understanding. But I do believe in the idea that DNA was brought to the Earth, and that's how things began.
Oh, this panspermia idea.
Exactly. That was Crick, and that was Francis Crick, the guy who discovered DNA in the 1950s. He put forward the panspermia theory, and I think something in that category is probably the truth.
It does seem, when you look at the evidence, you know, difficult to say the least to explain life originating from nothing on the Earth, you know, without any sort of exterior interference, shall we say. You know, because, you know, obviously there's been a lot of work in the interim with scientists trying to recreate some of the processes that they think did originate life on Earth, and, you know, they've singularly failed.
I don't know why they're so against it.
Yeah, it's a strange one. It really is. There's certain ideas that are, that, yeah, they run contrary to what you would call the standard model, but there are some areas where I've thought, you know, why is there such tremendous resistance to this idea?
I mean,
if it's only a matter of someone, yeah, people have to eat a bit of humble pie maybe in careers.
Yeah, yeah.
But there has to be more to it than that, surely.
In some cases, when you do scrutinize the situation and analyze it in depth, you discover that the that particular discipline, that field of knowledge, has been married to that idea for too long, and so it to change it would almost destroy the discipline. I think that's the thinking. Careers have been based, careers, books, everything has been based on that model. And how can you turn around and say, I was wrong, and then start from scratch? There's a lot of money invested in it. Part of this story comes out in chapter 4 of the book, where I go into the global warming problem. There's too much money invested in it. It's a gravy train. You can't turn around and say it's false.
We'll come on to the global warming thing shortly, but just a word again on evolution. Your idea about coexistence of various types of hominids and interbreeding, and that it wasn't just, you know, one step from, you know, Neanderthal and through the other names that don't spring to mind immediately, but just these various stages. You know, there's that famous illustration, isn't there, of what looks like a chimpanzee almost doubled over and then moves through a sequence of different types of hominids up to modern man. And that's the idea in everyone's mind. But I often thought this idea of the missing link, which is as missing as it's ever been. And you're not the first person I've read to suggest this idea, but there it is again. How about the missing link is missing because there isn't a link? How about it just doesn't exist, and that's why we can't find it?
Yeah. We might look a little bit like monkeys, but certain species resemble other species. It doesn't mean that they are our parents or our grandparents. As far as I can see, there's a complete separation between the animal kingdom and the human kingdom. I don't think they ever shared an ancestor.
There's also the idea of the gap in the fossil record. And what I've read, when I've discussed this with people, the answer I've usually had back is that the majority of life forms that were ever fossilized those fossils have actually been lost. They've been destroyed. And that's why we're only getting a partial record of what's there. I'm not completely satisfied with that, to be honest, but that's what I've had back. You know, basically that the fossils we see are only a tiny fraction of what you know, life that's ever existed on the Earth.
Yeah, it's very hard to fossilize for the ideal climate of preservation. So it's quite understandable that there's a lot that's just crumbled and gone forever. So we can't know everything about the past. I think that revelation it might be the next source of what happened in the past, rather than scientific scrutiny. It's all part of the coming spiritualization of the planet, that knowledge will come to us from higher intelligence above in the spirit world.
A sort of just a knowing, as opposed to scrabbling around and trying to learn over a long period of time.
Yeah, that's the prophecy that I'm looking at, where we will know things because we will open up the channel to the unseen. This is what we're becoming. We're going to realize our true potential.
Before we leave evolution behind, presumably your position then kind of makes the idea of transitional species to be not valid. I mean, the one I always think of is, you know, Archaeopteryx, the feathered dinosaur, which they claimed, it's halfway between dinosaur and bird. Now, as I understand it, they've only ever found about 10 fossils of Archaeopteryx, and they're not even, some people don't agree that they're actually the same species, but I'm guessing transitional species don't fit with your view of things.
Yeah, because the bird kingdom existed in the time of the dinosaurs, so that queers the whole chronology of it in the first place. There were birds even before dinosaurs, and in the age of the dinosaurs, there were primordial bird types.
And of course, the other thing that science has us allegedly established is that, again, the dinosaurs died out. Worth mentioning, that happened over a very long period of time. It wasn't sort of instantaneous by any means, even in evolutionary terms, and that then mammals came along and filled the gap. I don't know what your research would say about that particular.
I'll tell you what. And it touches on the global warming chapter, because that's where I indicate that the history of the Earth is really very simple. The Earth goes from a hot, molten ball of gases until it cools down and starts to solidify. And its entire history from that point on is a history of cooling and of drying. I believe that's what did in the dinosaurs, that, as you say, over a long period of time, probably a million years or more, they lived in a swampy type of environment, and it was also cooling. When the age of the dinosaurs ended, that is the same time that ice caps were first forming on the poles. So every animal species has a margin of heat beyond which it cannot survive. So I think the dinosaurs went extinct because of cooling and also drying. Their water holes dried up. And the next thing you had on Earth were the fur-covered species, cats and dogs and animals that were protected by a blanket of fur.
Of course, as I understand it, dinosaurs were cold-blooded as well.
Yeah, well, there's some controversy in that they may have also been warm-blooded.
Okay, well, that was just, again, I've not read any detail of that story for a very long time, so that's going back to my childhood, actually, that bit of information. Yeah, in terms of global warming, we talked earlier, you know, about the ages of different planetary bodies, or how there's a gradual movement from hot to cool over a very long period of time. And you're basically explaining that's what's going on just right here on Earth, as you'd expect, given that model, is that we're looking at very long-term cooling, and the Earth is actually well into that process now.
Yes, it's pretty obvious, even from the weather pattern of the 21st century. You know, the global warming thing started in the late 1980s. They were doing fine until around the year 2000 when the warming trend stopped. And that was only a short-term thing. That's like a 30 or 33-year spell of warming. There are fluctuations like that that climatologists know all about. 30 years of cooling, 30 years of warming, those are just small segments of time. We happen to be in a warm spell when the global warming thing started. You know, one generation before the global warming thing started, it was nuclear winter. I don't know if you're old enough to remember that.
Oh, yeah, in the 1970s, towards the end of the 1970s, when I was getting old enough to be able to think about this sort of thing. And I remember, if you'd asked me about it, I'd have said, oh, yeah, they, meaning scientists, are saying that we're heading for a new ice age and it might even happen in our lifetime. And there was a Time magazine, there's a very famous Time magazine cover from that era, which basically is ice age, get ready, it's coming.
Right, right. So those are just 30-year fluctuations. It happened to be a cool spell. I remember the winter of 77 was very cold. And then the warm period came in. But now, like I say, the global warming people were doing fine until around 2000. And at that point, we shifted back into a cool period. And we certainly have experienced that all over the planet in the last 15 years, the cooling. So, they're not even calling it global warming anymore. But you know what they're calling it now? Climate change. Because they're having to back off many of their assumptions because of the trends in the last 15 years. And like I say, there's too much money going into this. It's false. Every planet, not just Earth, every planet starts out as a hot thing and then cools on its way to extinction.
Yeah, I'm not interested personally in any of the political stuff to do with global warming, climate change, call it what you will. I'm interested in, is over a medium to long term, is the planet getting hotter or is it getting cooler? That's just what I'm interested in. I don't care about Al Gore or about who says why things are happening and what's causing it. And there's a big tendency here to conflate climate change with pollution. Now,
exactly.
The pollution is clearly an enormous problem. But that's not.
But it's not the same thing.
No.
The key word there is anthropomorphic when they try to say that it's man-made warming because we use so much energy and pollute the air, and then the issues get immediately confused. Pollution is one thing, but the temperature of the planet is quite another.
Yeah, and that's a tendency I get. I mean, I don't actually know. I don't pretend to have any kind of, definitive knowledge about warming or cooling on the planet. It's part of the reason why I talk to people like yourself to see if I can gain any more insights. But if you ask questions about climate change, if it's happening, how and where it's happening, what might the causes be, you then get put in this box with people who apparently do not care about the environment. And, that's just a way of trying to shut people up.
It's a whole politically correct thing. I can't think of a better example. If I had to explain what politically correct means to someone who doesn't know the term, I would explain it and then use the global warming thing as an example. It's become politically correct, and that's really messed up because it's not politically correct, and it's not even true.
It's interesting, we were talking about dinosaurs a few minutes ago, and one of the things I remember clearly reading my books about it when I was a boy was the pictures, that showed all the lush vegetation, and the books would always say, the Earth was much warmer at the time of the dinosaurs, and that's kind of like a given, but no one then considered if it hasn't been that warm since then, what might that tell us about long-term trends?
Yeah, I think that's why I wrote chapter 3 on the Ice Age. In the book, Delusions, chapter 1 is the Big Bang. Chapter 2 is Darwin and evolution. And I get all those issues discussed. Chapter 3 and 4, now, Chapter 3 leads up to Chapter 4. Chapter 4 is global warming, but Chapter 3 is the ice ages. And that is, that ties in directly to the claim of global warming, because as you just posed the question, is the planet warming, is it cooling? Okay, here's what the experts tell us, that it might be warming, it might be cooling, because it depends on whether we're in an ice age or not in an ice age. What I do in Chapter 3 is refute the entire idea of ice ages altogether. It's not possible for a planet to freeze up and then get warm again and then freeze up again and then get warm again. That's not what planets do. They just very, very gradually cool down. So, excuse me. So I spend time in Chapter 3 explaining how we came up with the idea of ice age and what alternative ideas could explain the ice on Earth and the glacial scratch marks on rocks and stuff like that.
And we were talking earlier about the movements, the types of movement that we see in action on small and large scales in the universe. And of course, in your chapter about ice ages, you explain how different at different periods of time, ice caps on the Earth could have been at different locations, as it were, because of the way that the Earth is actually moving. But again, it's over a very, very long period of time, so we don't readily perceive this. And this goes some way to explaining ideas about, you know, accepted ideas that Antarctica was once free of ice and that India may have been covered in ice at some stage.
Yeah, I believe the only way to explain the presence of ice in places like Africa and India is to adopt the model of a third motion of the Earth. We are familiar with the rotation of the Earth on a daily basis and the revolution of the Earth on a yearly basis, and that's about it. But now, if you take into consideration a third motion of the Earth, and maybe we could call it oscillation, where the North Pole and South Pole change places over a period of hundreds of thousands of years. So the Earth is actually rolling. Think of a beach ball rolling. And the continent that is at the pole is slowly moving toward the equator and moving to the other pole. Now, this is basically known and understood in science, and it's called magnetic reversal. They also call it pole shift. However, they misunderstand its dynamic. Some people have taken the pole shift to mean a sudden, catastrophic flip. But that's not how it worked. And the presence of ice in all these continents that are warm right now is only an example or even a proof of the fact that those land masses have been moving in oscillatory motion.
And of course, this taps into a lot of ideas, mythical ideas about, you know, Atlantis and Lemuria and Thule and Hyperborea and all these, you know, lands that may or may not have existed, and it puts in context how it's possible for something, you know, an entire civilization to have radically changed or been absolutely wiped out if you allow for the fact of these, you know, enormous movements over a very long period of time. And what that also does is open up human history to a much longer time frame.
Well, how much longer do you think?
Oh, I have absolutely no idea. I know that Graham Hancock, the popular writer on archaeology and other subjects.
I know Graham.
Yeah, well, he likes to post on social media little stories under the headline of Stuff Keeps Getting Older. And he does this like a couple of times a month, every time that some discovery is made that suggests that human history, you know, is much longer than we're being led to believe.
Well, okay. To me, yes, there is a lost civilization and a lost race that we have not confronted properly, and that is a true fact. However, it doesn't mean that we have to go further back in time. I indicated before that my time frame for humanity only goes back 75,000 years. Most of these theorists, like Graham and others in a similar school of thought, try to give us millions of years of history. I don't think we have it. I think it's our history. We've been on the planet for a much shorter period of time, but that does not discount lost continents and a lost civilization. I believe you can go back 50 or 60,000 years for a lost civilization with all the trimmings. And it was lost and it came back again. And the last time we knew it came back was in Egypt or in the Fertile Crescent 8 or 10,000 years ago.
Towards the end of the book, then you take, as I say, wide-ranging to say the least, you take another turn and you look at the unconscious, the human psyche. And I think this is very important because even in the light of all the subjects we've been talking about, this is one area that you see is very important, particularly going forward, and that this is something that we've, particularly contemporary science, has tended to ignore or marginalize or push into a corner. Everything from dreams, ghosts, precognition, ESP, near-death experiences, you name it, but it's all been marginalized. It's kind of, yes, there's study taking place, but it's, this stuff isn't really important. It's all epiphenomena of the brain and not to be taken too seriously.
Right. And that's the problem, because they have shoved aside all the unseen principles. They've shoved aside spirit. They've shoved aside soul. They've shoved aside the human psyche. Instead, they want to give us the brain. They want to give us something material. And they want to come up with theories that cast our psyche in darkness. And that theory is called the unconscious or the collective unconscious, and say that all kinds of stuff comes out of there and it's just darkness and we're not aware of it. I don't believe that's true at all. I think it's another conjecture. And I think that's turning over now. I think we've got enough information in front of us that something else is going on.
Yeah, and that's a big trend I've noticed. You know, in my lifetime of, you know, being interested in this area, is that things have really begun to open up, and it's become harder and harder for people to ignore this, despite the rise to prominence of popular materialists such as Richard Dawkins or whatever, who incidentally deny their own subjective experience when they in their writing. But yeah, there's definitely changes afoot. There's no question about it. Interestingly, you have a chapter where you're looking at reincarnation and the idea of past lives. And I read that with great interest because, again, this is something that's of great interest to me, but for me, the jury is still out, although you don't believe it is, because I actually had recently a past life regression hypnosis session. And it was most interesting to read your chapter in the light of what I experienced. First of all, it kind of confirmed what I thought, which was that I couldn't be hypnotized. The lady was not able to hypnotize me, but I was put into a somnambulant state, extremely relaxed. And I had these gestalt downloads of former lives that I did not have time to think about. Very, very unusual experience. I did not have time to come up with a backstory, but she asked me questions and it all just came out. Bam, there's that life. I don't know who this person was or when they were, but it was very detailed. And it was like an instant download. So I'm just wondering what I experienced, if not some past life, what was that?
Well, in my viewpoint, you were put into a alternate state of consciousness. That's a concept I use a lot in that chapter, ASDs, alternate state of consciousness. And in that state of consciousness, your normal barrier, quite normal barrier, that we all possess, that keeps us separate from the spirit entities, that barrier come down because of the alpha state or whatever it is that you were put in. And in that case, entities from the unseen can come in and give their life stories, and you can be, and you are then made to believe that it's your own, it was your own life in some time in the past. I don't believe that. I believe those are people in the spirit world and who are eager to participate in the earth plane instead of moving on as they should. And so I think the whole reincarnation theory has been built on that sort of dynamic.
Towards the end of the book, you mentioned Egypt, for example, there. You talk about the rise and fall of civilizations, and this kind of brings everything in the book together, you know, the idea of golden ages, dark ages, and that we're actually in a sort of a cycle. It isn't just one way. And the idea, as I mentioned earlier in the interview, that we see ourselves as somehow at the apex of civilization is very misplaced.
Right. Well, the cycles that would pertain to what you're talking about are 3,000-year cycles, starting with the first prophet. The first prophet of man was Zarathustra, and that was 9,000 years ago. And he opened the new dawn. That was a new dawn similar to the dawn of Cosmin that we're experiencing now. He opened a new dawn 9,000 years ago. He was a great prophet and went among the people. And he reformed the people and enlightened the people. And that carried on for hundreds of years. But then toward the end of the 3,000-year cycle, and this pertains to every one of these 3,000-year cycles, there's a darkening, and the teachings are forgotten, and people go to war, and things fall apart until it's real black. And then a new cycle is born. So 6,000 years ago came the prophets Brahma, Abraham, Po in China, and Hiawatha in America. And each of those in those four places started a new cycle. They were the prophets of man. And then it repeated itself. It caught on. It spread like wildfire. And then it spun out. And then 3,000 years after that came Moses and a new cycle. So, yes. And this is something you can find if you look into prophecy, that every 3,000 years there's the darkness, there's the light overcoming the darkness. The Zarathustran system, which ended with the Farsis, schematized the whole scheme of life as the god of darkness fighting the god of light. And that's how they came up with it, because it's a cyclical thing. So yes, it's understood that civilizations come and go based on the cycles of time.
So where do you think we find ourselves now?
Well, now we're at a new point, because this is more than a 3,000-year cycle that we've just entered. This is a 24. It's a major block, 24,000-year cycle, and like I say, it's the midpoint for us. And from now on, after we clear away all the debris of this dark civilization, then we begin anew and we build our true destiny.
Is this connected either with the precession of the equinoxes or the movement of the solar system around the galaxy?
It might be, but I'm not aware of it. But I do think it connects with the roadway of the stars, because the way I've seen it described is that, you know, the Earth and all the family of planets in the solar system are moving through the universe. And every 3,000 years, there's like a strip of light, and that represents coming into light regions in the cosmos. And then you travel on, and it gets darker and darker. And then 3,000 years later, there's another strip of light, and we enter into that.
Just a closing thought here, and this is something you'll have come across and thought about. it's pretty much the reason why I'm doing this in the first place, is that all my life I've noticed this tendency when it comes to certain types of information, certain types of knowledge, particularly about the past and particularly about the past of humanity, is that there's certain types of information where the mainstream and the establishment is, don't look at this. Don't look at this. And I've never really fully understood it. I mean, is it really just to maintain the status quo? Or is there something that we've forgotten about ourselves that some people, well, I don't need entities, I don't know, so that some force does not want us to look at?
Greg, it's the powers that be, my dear. The powers that be do not want to lose their high place.
Now, Susan, today we've been talking about your new book. Just to remind listeners once again, it's Delusions in Science and Spirituality, The Fall of the Standard Model and the Rise of Knowledge from Unseen Worlds. That's easily available everywhere. You said you don't have a personal website, but tell folks about the website that you did mention earlier, so they, if they want to go and have a look at that.
Earthvortex.com.
Okay, we'll have a link up to that on your interview page. Well, thanks once again, Susan, for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
And thank you so much for having me, Greg. It was really terrific.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Based on current audience numbers, if everyone who tuned in donated just 5 pence per show, that's about 8 cents US, this could become a full-time, fully funded operation, offering more and more often. During October 2014, over 50,000 of you streamed or downloaded at least one show. Total donations were £7, which currently converts to about $11 US. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.